And welcome to Endercast, more fun than a game of buggers and astronauts. You are listening to episode 18, Graph. Today is June 15th, 2013. I'm Kelly from endernews.com, here with Crystal from enderwiggin.net. Say hi, Crystal.
Hey, everyone. And so the reason we are calling today's episode Graph is because Graph is a kernel, as you guys all know, and our special guest for today is Colonel Tom Roby. He is a retired Air Force colonel who contributed an essay to Ender's World, the anthology put out by SmartPop Books. His essay was titled Ender on Leadership. So say hi, Tom.
Hi, everybody.
All right. So can you give us a bit of background on your fanship for Ender's Game, basically?
Well, sure. You know, I knew about Ender's Game for a really long time before I ever picked it up and read it. Maybe I was a little bit too proud to listen to all these people that were telling me, you got to read this book. This is really great. And isn't that how we all, you know, want to pick up a book, is when our friends or somebody that we trust tells us it's really great, you should pick it up. And I got to the point where enough people had said it to me that I finally did. And when I did, I thought, man, you're a real moron. You should have done this a long time ago when you were first, you know, when you first had it recommended to you, not 15 years later.
Well, better late than never, right?
Better late than never is right. Well, it made such an impression on me that I thought it would be really important for me to tell other people about it as well. So I started recommending the book. I was in Lexington, Kentucky at the time. I was a lieutenant colonel at the time. I was going through the doctoral program at the University of Kentucky in political science. And Orson Scott Card was coming to speak at Joseph Beth Booksellers, which is a really wonderful independent bookstore in Lexington. And they have great speakers that they bring in periodically. And I thought, this is an opportunity that you can't pass up. So I took my, whatever, 23rd edition hardback copy of Ender's Game to listen to him speak and then to have him sign it for me. And while I was standing in line, you know, most of the other people had 15 or 20 books in hand, and I just, you know, politely slid the one book on the table and smiled, told him thank you, and I told him that I really appreciated what he said in his talk about writing like you speak and not writing like an English teacher teaches you to write, because that's not conversational and that doesn't carry a story. And he said, oh, thanks. And he looked up at me and then he started signing his name and he stopped and looked back up again and said, you're not like everybody else here. I said, well, I don't know about that. And he says, what do you do? And I told him I was an Air Force lieutenant colonel that was going through graduate school. And that led to some emails and it led to a friendship. And a couple of years later, when I graduated from UK, I went back to the Air Command and Staff College in Montgomery, Alabama. I was promoted to colonel and was the associate dean there. And we brought him in 2 years in a row to speak to the class. And that was pretty neat. So my relationship with Scott Card, the story of Ender's Game, and what it could be for leadership and leadership development started way back when I first read the book, and it's continued to today.
The Air Command and Staff College, is that where you made reading Ender's Game a part of the curriculum? Is that the same place?
Yes. Yes, I did. And that was a struggle.
Yeah, you mentioned in your essay that there was opposition. So all the people that doubted you putting the book into the curriculum, had they read the book or no?
Why would you read something that's so obviously stupid that you shouldn't read in the first place, right? I mean, that's the opposition that I ran into. There is a different mindset, and I mean, all of us intrinsically know this, right? It doesn't, if you work in one field, you know that you're going to have a different mindset from those that work in another field. That's natural, right? I mean, biologists think differently than physicists, and scientists think differently than writers. And so the faculty at the Air Command and Staff College is really wonderfully diverse because it's an interdisciplinary program. You know, we have historians and political scientists and sociologists and people with various backgrounds in different education from different universities and different fields of study. You might imagine what it would be like for the political scientists getting into discussion with historians. You might also wonder, and imagine to yourself that when I, as a political scientist, come back and say, hey, I want to put this in the curriculum and I want to bring him to speak, what the historians might say, for example, what could our students possibly learn from a fiction author and a science fiction author at that?
I work at a university, so I understand how fickle faculty can be sometimes. So I thought that was really interesting. In your essay, you mentioned that you saw a lot of parallels between the university environment and the military environment. So I thought that was really interesting.
Yeah, there are parallels, especially, neither side likes the other. And I say that as though they're sides in a fight, because they're really not. But in general, having been in both academia and in the military for a very good portion of my adult life, neither academia nor the military trust the other. And yet they're okay. So much alike, and they don't realize how alike they are. And I think that, I don't know if it would be too flippant to say, but if either side realized how much like the other they were, they might try to change just to not be like this, like the other people that they say that they don't like.
But I think that's very common with even two individuals who butt heads. They're always way more alike than they think, and neither are willing to like give in to that.
You know, that's a really good point. There's a really short novel that I might recommend from G.K. Chesterton, written probably around 1912 or so, around that era. And it's called The Ball and the Cross. And it's a short novel, and it's an outstanding read about these two guys that try to have a duel. And so they're looking for a place to have a duel, but they keep getting interrupted, i.e. it's illegal to try to kill each other. So in the quest to find a place that they can have a duel, they get to know each other.
Right.
And as they get to know each other, they form a respect for one another.
Right.
But then it's still absurd enough that they're still trying to find a place to duel. And that's such a great analogy for how our whole world works. And I think that's an analogy that Scott Card might even tell you that is behind Ender's desire to know and love
his enemy.
Do you think that when it comes to fiction being looked down upon sort of in academia, do you think that sci-fi is especially looked down upon because everyone feels that it's just, like you say in your essay, robots and alien invasions? Because I know like for one reason I really like Ender's Game and things like Star Trek as opposed to maybe Star Wars is that like in Star Trek, everyone's potentially good. It's about morals and ethics. There's no black and white. And they sort of explore these sociological ideas of how things could be or like how things might be in the future. And I think people don't really realize that if they don't read sci-fi.
Yes, there's two parts to that question. If I could break them apart, I think.
Yeah, sure.
The first one would be about, and I found it to be primarily the historians, okay, because they have a different understanding of the world than, let's say, social scientists like sociologists, economists, and political scientists. And I would say that, let's see, sociologists, economists, and political scientists are looking for the linkage between the empirical and the theoretical, whereas there are not a lot of historians that I know, okay? And so that's how I am qualifying this. There are not a lot of historians that I know that really seek to say, okay, I'm going to tell you what happened, but that's only good in the context of what you can learn from it or what variables we can derive. There's, I can name you two historians that do that, and it's interesting because one is a student of the other. Russell Weigley, who is perhaps the greatest American military historian that we've had, and one of his students, who is now a wonderful historian in his own right, Kevin Holzimer, when Weigley wrote, he didn't just say, this is what happened on this date, this is how many guys died in this battle. what he did is he looked at a concept over time and said, this repeatedly failed. Why should we believe that it would be different today? Okay. Right. So when I wanted to bring Ender's Game into the curriculum, what I got was, what can we learn that's valuable today? And I would say the only place that you can explore what has not yet happened is in fiction.
Fiction, yeah.
Okay? So history can tell you what did happen, or what one person tells you happened based on the evidence that that person has gathered. Mm. Only in fiction can you explore what might happen or what has not yet happened.
So since you have military and education background, do you think a program such as Battle School would be viable, or is it a little too fiction?
I don't think it's too fiction at all. I think that you can, listen, the future is many, not one. Does that make sense?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so we all know, you know, based on Star Trek, we'll get back to that second part of that question in a sec, okay? That it, you know, whatever outcome we take today with all, you know, everything that we decide to do somehow or another alters the path that we're going. So I could come up with lots of scenarios, I'm sure. So could everybody. I know you have thought about this, right?
Yeah.
Under which, what would be the social conditions under which we thought it was important enough to
give up our children?
You know, to determine who'd be good leaders and not.
Yeah.
Okay. I could see that that could happen. You know, look at what we do with football and basketball today. Okay. And even in tennis, our great tennis players started playing when they're teeny little kids, right?
Yeah.
And they go to Florida and learn under Nick Baltieri, or else they're not going to make it, you know, on the tour. Football players are getting younger and younger to get scholarships, right? Southern Cal gave a scholarship to a seventh grader a few years ago. University of Kentucky just offered a scholarship to a seventh grader 2 days ago.
Wow.
For football.
What?
And do you think
are you
that
serious?
That's a good thing? I'm just, it makes me really hesitant. Like,
well, I'm not saying that it's good or bad.
Right.
You see, when we talk about social scientists look at the intersection between what could be and what is and why. Okay.
Right.
Whereas historians will tell you what happened. And so I'm not saying that it's a good thing that kids are being given scholarship offers. What I'm saying is that just like in Ender's Game,
they see the potential.
You're seeing the potential very early because you've actually constructed. This is where this concept of the, you know, the political philosophy of constructivism comes up. You've constructed a world in which you're looking specifically for these people,
right?
And you built a system in to identify these kids. And essentially, once you build the system, the kids naturally want to funnel into it, right?
Mm-hmm.
So when John Calipari has, you know, he goes around and has these camps, these one-day camps that kids go to and they pay money to come into, to learn something and really to get a picture with Coach Cal, right? But he also has the opportunity to see kids that he knows that if they're really good, they're going to figure out a way to get to that camp for that day.
Right.
So he can see them. And
it's so weird because we've had so many discussions on here about how, you know, whether or not it's realistic that children of that age are capable of these things. And, like, you know, we went through Orson Scott Card's introduction where he got that letter. I don't know if you've read that. He got a letter from someone saying she was complaining that, you know, gifted children don't act like that. They don't speak like that, and that it was completely unrealistic. And we've had that discussion.
Well,
whether
that's
or not.
BS, because kids really do.
Right.
You know, and you guys know about have you ever heard of the Duke Scholars Program?
No.
No.
Okay, so Duke University gives scholarships to kids based on their PSAT scores, okay?
Right.
So kids that take the PSAT, like in seventh or eighth grade, if they're really high, Duke has a separate dorm and a separate program to take kids into college.
Really?
I had no idea.
Okay? So these are teenagers that are going to be graduating when they're 18, and they realize we can't put them in with the over boozed and oversexed, you know, 18 to 22 crowd. So they put him essentially in a separate, just like battle school, in a separate area where they go to school and they graduate, and it's all scholarship.
Okay? And do they push these kids in a certain direction for jobs, or?
Well, my guess is that that takes care of itself. This is a guess now, but that companies would want kids like that.
Yeah.
If you're a high company, you know, you're going to want young kids. So you can say, first of all, you know, there's a lot of reasons to hire kids like that. There's a perspective, because it's going to be cheaper on healthcare, you know, I mean, lots of reasons, but not the least of which is they can work for a longer period of time than somebody that's older, and they have a different perspective. And so we asked this question about, is it likely that anything like this could ever happen? And my response is, it happens all the time.
Right.
And it has been happening, I bet, as far as we can go back and look back.
Okay, so these, I'm assuming, were teenagers, like younger teenagers?
Yeah, like 13 to 18.
Okay, so I guess that brings me to another one of our questions. Putting yourself in Graf's shoes. I was going to ask this in general, but I think maybe we could make it more specific. Do you feel that, like, putting yourself in Graf's shoes, do you think that he really did need to have Ender from that young age? Or do you think that a young teenager, like, you know, you mentioned, like, that seventh grader being recruited for football. Do you think that, like, 13 is young enough of an age? Or, I mean, even 11, because I think 11 is the age that they recruit Ender in the movie. Do you think that's young enough to be able to mold a person? Or do you think that Graf needed to have him from age 6, like he did in the book? Because I feel like it would have been probably a little easier, maybe, on Ender.
Weirdly enough, I immediately think, how would Ender have been if he would have spent those years in that house with Peter and Valentine? Like, how much would that have changed him, you know? He would have been, like, a completely different kid, I think.
Well, let's break that apart again and recognize, why did the movie do that from 11 to 6? Or from 6 to 11? I think that was I really do think it was necessary, because in a two-hour film, you know, in
can't
a
have 10 different actors.
Film, yeah, you have to get rid of 5 years. It's just an easier way to do it. Okay. Second, I'm really humbled by you guys calling this episode Graf. I tell you with all sincerity, I could never consider myself to be Colonel Graf. However,
you can be Colonel Graf for a day.
I need Colonel Graf for a day. He does. He is the consummate professional. I can use another quote from G.K. Chesterton that sums up Graf in saying that the military officer does what he does not because he hates what's in front of him, but because he loves what's behind him.
Mm.
Isn't that wonderful?
Yeah, I mean, that's always something Graf, I've admired about Graf's character is, you know, I mean, in those introductions to the chapters.
He loves more than his country. He loves humanity.
Yeah.
And he realizes that we can never let this happen again. And if it wasn't for the very human realities of a bureaucracy that, you know, when you study bureaucracy, this is something else that Orson Scott Card has right. How, you know, a lot of people say, how could Graf ever get away with that kind of power without oversight? Well, look at what just happened in the last couple of weeks in this country, right? People get away with power without oversight all the time.
Yeah.
And so that's one part of the question, how could he do it? Did he need to do it? Well, I think that in the story, it's very clear that Ender never would have ended up in battle school without Graf, okay, that we never would have had a fleet of commanders, and, you know, not everybody was Ender. They were looking for the commander, but they also realized that they needed lots of other subordinate commanders, lots of other people to go to other different kinds of schools and do other things, and he had that vision. Now, is that vision any different from what we need today in a functioning military and in a functioning society? not everybody is going to be a wing commander, okay, to command a fighter wing. But some people are going to be intelligence officers. Some people are going to be doctors. Some people are going to be mechanics. Same thing in the world, right? We need that diversity. And Graf was building all of it at the same time while specializing on the one person to lead them.
Okay, so...
Can I throw one more thing out?
Yeah.
I'd like to bring this up, and that's that Graf understood something, and I think everybody that reads the book gets this, but I don't hear many people talk about it. And that's that Graf understood the human psyche so well that he knew that there are some things that kids will do that adults won't do.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
Okay? And if you look around the world today, people would say, well, Graf is just as bad as those African warlords, right, in the Congo that take kids and turn them into killers. Well, I disagree with that. On some level, you can make an equivalence there, but I think it's a really false equivalent.
Yeah, he has completely different motivations, right, obviously.
Yes, that's what makes it different, are his motivations. He foresees from the very beginning that you have a near threat and then you have implications and complications of doing that. And what Graf decides is that you have to act, okay? Wringing your hands all day long and saying, these are really bad choices, is not helpful. You know, after 9/11, I heard so many people in my own graduate program, you know, professors at the University of Kentucky saying, well, if this had been different 20 years ago, maybe we wouldn't be in the place that we are now. And my response was, that's a really interesting conversation, but what are you going to do now? Now that threat is there. And they would say, well, if it didn't, and I'd say, stop with the ifs. You have to take the world as it is, not as you'd like it to be. And so what Graf is saying is, I know that I'm going to create this problem that we'll deal with in the Bean sequels. But we'll get to that after we survive as a race. And if we don't survive as a race, we don't have to worry about it.
Yeah. Segueing into the film, do you think that they have enough time in these 2 hours to develop like the nuances in Graf's character to show that he did have this motivation? Or do you think that he's going to end up looking like kind of the bad guy? Because I'm curious,
they have the time. That's not an issue. My concern before I ever go to see the movie is that they will make Graf and Ender both, and probably Bean too, look like psychopaths. Okay. I don't know what other word to use that's more gentle, but that's my fear, is that you will have a very good and exciting movie.
Right.
That does not have that development. And that development, even in a 2-hour movie, I mean, you can make that entire character development essentially in 3 or 4 scenes with just the discussion with somebody else, you know, like 2 or 3 sentence discussions where the audience can glimpse that he is thinking about the future consequences. But I'm very concerned that will happen. I mean, never once in Starship Troopers was Heinlein's discussion of, you know, the importance of who gets to vote and decide things in a pluralistic society ever brought forward.
Well,
no, it was about shower scenes, right? And so I'm concerned in Ender's Game that they're going to make Graf look like a sociopathic loose cannon colonel.
Just playing with his battle school puppets.
Obviously, we're very limited in what we can say, but Crystal and I did visit the set, and I don't know how much you know, talking to Card and everything, but just talking to everyone there and talking to Gavin Hood and the people, I mean, obviously, you know, they're going to say things to us that sound great, but I got the impression that they understood, like, the heart and soul and, like, the story behind everything. Like, I find it unlikely that at the end of the film, I'm going to be like, oh my God, you know, that they looked crazy and no one's going to understand that. I try to be very optimistic about it just due to the fact that from what they were saying to us, I felt they understood the story. Crystal, what do you think? Is that,
well,
are you?
I mean, for me, it's interesting you mentioned being afraid that they're going to look like psychopaths, because one of the things that I am most afraid of is the Stilson scene, because I feel like that, I mean, that comes very early on, and that has the potential to really make Ender look like an unlikable character. I feel like they have to handle that very carefully, and that's actually the basis for a lot of my arguments on why they needed to age the characters up, because I don't feel like they could have filmed
six-year-olds
beating each other to death without people just being disgusted with Ender as a character. So
I think it does set a tone for the film.
At what point do you love your children and the successive generations enough to allow them to learn important lessons and to fail? How do you put them in a situation in which the kid's not under your complete protection all the time? You know, people today have this deep discussion that says, I can't let my kid out there. How will I protect him?
Yeah.
And you say, and my response to that is, what are you going to do when the kid's out on their own?
Yeah.
Never seen a snake or a stranger. And, you know, clearly in the book, Ender clearly, very, very clearly, this is why I think it's not hard if you're a director to do this. Ender didn't know that he killed him.
Yeah.
Right.
Okay? Yeah. Ender was trying to protect himself.
For me, it's about the audience. Like, what does the audience think? Do they know? Do they know any of these kids are dead? Like, what do they see? Like, it's the difference between, like, what I'm sitting in my seat seeing. I know that Ender doesn't know. It's like a delicate balance, like, in which way they film it, which way it comes off on screen, in my opinion. Like, if it has to be obvious that Ender didn't realize, or that he was doing it because of this and this and this reason. Otherwise, it's just going to come off as this, like, awful. I guess that just worries me a lot. Like, I just don't.
I think it should worry you. I think that in a movie like this, it ought to worry you, because unless you know that the director is going to make it clear from the book that Ender
didn't mean to
kill the kid.
Yeah.
On the other hand, I have to say that I can
change the character. If he does not do that, then the director is now changing the character of Ender Wiggins.
Mm-hmm.
From who he really is. And that's where my concern comes in with any movie. And it's probably unfair for me to have this concern before seeing the film. Okay.
Yeah, you know, I'm actually going to read a line from your essay that it's actually one of the things that stood out most to me. It says, rendering Ender hapless, lucky, or a puppet is a crime against his fictional being. And I thought that was really, I really like that line.
Yeah.
Because I feel like that captures what a lot of book fans are hoping for, or hoping does not happen with the movie adaptation. You know, people just want to see Ender's character come through. I think that's what most people are concerned about.
I think that's my concern as well, because the deeply personal characters in this book really can be developed by good writers and directors. And that's going to be the big question is, are they? Are they as developed as they can be? And do you do honor to his actual character and not change his character into something else? You know, you mentioned, Kelly, about Star Trek earlier. The Star Trek Literary Library grew after the series, right? And it has grown over the years. We have all we know about Ender from Ender's Game, the book,
right,
30 years ago. And the story upon which it was founded that, you know, appeared in Analog. And that hasn't been, you know, the only person that's expanded in that is Orson Scott Card. And he never changed anything. All he did in the other books was add more color to what was already there. So if the movie does anything differently, it can still be a good film as a film, but it really needs to be seen separately. I guess one reason that I could be more willing to go see the movie than I otherwise wouldn't be is that I'm very confident that if the movie company, if the studio, really neutered Ender to the point that I discussed in my essay, I have a feeling that Scott Card would have been jumping up and down on tables, figuratively, not literally, and stepping away from the movie and telling people very overtly, this is not my character.
I do feel that he has distanced himself from the movie quite a lot. I'm sure he has his reasons for that, and probably many, many failed attempts to get this going has made him very hesitant to really sign on. But in his, I know he wrote like a set visit report, and he gave a moderately positive view of the entire situation. You know, I can't possibly know how he feels about that. And I think it's weird for me because I am extremely easy to please when it comes to like movie adaptations of books. Because for me, it's like, I've said this like a billion times, but the book is the book and it's not going to get like erased or something. It's always going to be there. And for me, it's just like extra fun. It's like, you know, getting to see the battle room, getting to see these characters on screen and in space, right? It's like a, you know, popcorn movie possibly, you know, like even if they did do all these things to Ender, I would watch it and I'd be like, that was cool. And it's easier for me because I'm not the author. I'm not someone who, I don't know. It's just, I enjoy films, and I guess, I mean, like you were saying earlier, what Starship Troopers did for the novel was so unfortunate. I mean, do you think that's a possibility with Ender's Game? Do you think it's not already like contained enough in itself that people recognize that these are two like completely separate entities? Or,
well, I think the time between this is—I'll do some really bad math in my head—but I think that the time between Heinlein's authoring of the book and the movie coming out is about the same time between Ender coming out as a book and the movie coming out. I don't know. I think that's my fear. I am very concerned that a bad adaptation of a movie or of a book, a bad movie adaptation of the book, sullies the book for a really long time. I can tell you that a good
right.
adaptation of a book, if you look at a really good adaptation of Sense and Sensibility, if you look at the good adaptation of Jane Eyre that came out, what, 3 or 4 years ago, that only helped the book.
Right.
Okay.
Have you seen the trailer?
I have.
What did you think?
I have seen the trailer. I can't wait to see the movie just based on the trailer alone.
So you liked it? Good.
I do.
It looks fun, right?
I'm a little, you know, I have to look at the jets. I mean, it looks like we're flying, you know, F-35s or F-22s or something like that against, you know, these alien
swarms. I really loved how like they were actually it was just crazy. Like, you have to really slow the trailer down and get a good look at the bugger fleet and how they're like bees.
Yeah,
I like it a lot. Yeah,
right, they really are like swarms, and you wonder when it's portrayed like that how we could have ever
how we could possibly have survived.
You know, and so that's a really, I like the trailer. You know, I like the trailer. I remember from the book, you know, in the trailer when, you know, Bean hooks the wire around himself.
Right.
And jumps. You know, that brought back really strong memories from the book. You know, throws his arms out and stops. And you know, I like how the light suits look.
What did you think of the battle room?
Yeah, the battle room.
Because, like, everyone was complaining at how boring it looked, or how boring it was in their heads, and how the movie was way too cool, and I'm like, wait, what?
Well, the beauty of the battle room, cool. The beauty of what Scott Card did in the battle room in the book is he allowed you,
as that was all imagination.
Yeah.
To envision it, okay? By not describing the details of the battle room, all he told you was that it was Nullo, right?
Yeah.
And that there was an entrance on one side and that there was an entrance on the other, okay? And that it was modularizable. So in my mind, I pictured it a certain way. Okay, I can't. You know, I'm really looking forward to seeing it with lights, without lights. You know, with the stars inside there, with nothing inside there. I'm really looking forward to seeing that in the movie.
Me too. Like, I think I'm such a bad person to talk to about this because I don't take anything seriously enough when it comes to movies. I'm just like, that's great. that looks great. I love the costumes. Like, I just don't, I love books. And, well, like, that's where my passion is. Like, and I'm not going to, because it doesn't change anything for me. Well, and I guess it's just hard to be like, I don't know.
It must be hard to do the websites and the podcast when you're specifically interviewing people that about caring.
Well, no, I mean, it's not that I don't care. And it's like, I understand people's like point of view. And I just have a hard time because I'm very cautious. I'm like, well, if it's bad, then it's bad. And, you know, I still love Ender's Game and it's not going to change anything for me. And I just don't like worrying about it because whatever it is, it's just, you know.
Tom, I mean, me and Kelly have talked about this quite a bit about how we don't feel like the movie will hurt the book any or hurt people's experience reading the book. But you know, you did bring up a point that I never thought about, that the movie can potentially prevent people from reading the book that have not read the book, because we've always been talking about how it won't hurt people's book experiences, but we're talking about fans who have already read the book. So, I mean, you did bring up a factor that I hadn't thought about, you know, that, I mean, with the Starship Troopers thing, that it might turn people off on the book. And yeah, I do think that that's a valid concern, so.
Yeah, so do I. I think I'm just way too cautiously optimistic about things, where I'm like, you know.
Well, I would tell you that you could think back to your own experiences in school. Go back to your own experiences at some point in school when you had to read a book and all of your classmates, or at least some of them, would say, let's just watch the movie instead.
Yeah, and I was just never that kid, and that's what I mean, though. Like,
yeah,
books
to me
are... you're
different. You're an outlier. Yeah. Okay, you really are an outlier. Okay, so, you know, there are going to be people that would rather watch the movie than to read the book, no matter what the book is. Okay?
Well, but that's like, those people,
and
man,
the more spectacular the movie is, the shallower the movie is, the more, unfortunately, lots of people are going to like it.
Yeah, and you know, I think that's unfortunate, but I think that's a society thing. And not, I mean, you know, if they make this movie that's like lots of explosions and it's awesome with spaceships, that's what people want to see in the cinema. And I mean, I remain confident that they have taken the story behind Ender's Game, and I think that they really understand it. We visited, Gavin Hood just gave like a really passionate speech while we were there, which hopefully we'll be able to like talk about soon, about what he wanted to keep from like the story.
Well, why does it have to be an either or? Why does it have to be either or? Why does it have to be either the movie?
Oh no,
you know,
it doesn't.
Like the book,
I'm hoping that it's not.
My point is that there are lots of good movies that are made based on really good stories.
Yeah, sure.
And again, it's kind of, I feel almost unfair talking about it because I haven't seen the movie yet, and it's like,
right.
I'm almost trying to put some armor on prior to going to get a spear, you know, or an arrow shot at me. But what I really want, for people to continue to read this book in years to come. I want people to, for this book to be on the reading list like it is for years to come, for another 30 years. I don't want it to fall off people's reading lists like so many other authors have fallen off.
I completely agree with you. That would be like worst case scenario. Is that possible? Of course it is. I really just hope that's not the case, I guess. And I, you know, the movie's being made and we'll see in November, I guess, what they've done with it. That's, you know, all I can do at this point. I'm like, okay, well, we'll see.
And I think it'd be good to come back and talk about this again in November. You know?
That'd be great, yeah.
But
it's
as far
so
as the
weird.
Book goes, there's so much still to recommend the book for. You know,
yeah.
There's still so much that you can learn. And when my daughter Veronica, who she's now 15, when she read this book when she was 13 and was walking down the hallway, you know, from her room to our room at 11 o'clock at night and saying, Dad, no way. I didn't see it coming. Okay. That's brilliant.
Exactly.
That's
yeah.
what you want out of a book. That's what you want a person to experience with the book. That's what you want to be able to discuss with people and say, let's talk about situations today that are similar that we can learn from this.
I was 14 when I read Ender's Game, and when I got to that scene at the end when you like find out what's going on, I literally closed the book and threw it across the room. And then it was like 60 seconds of me like understanding something, and then I went and picked it up and like went on, but it was just so awful. And I don't think that there's going to be that moment in the movie. I don't think that they can pull that off. I think that's completely impossible for like the viewers to not know. Like I have no idea.
Well, again, the viewers are going to be mostly people that have read the book.
Yeah, initially, well,
you know, the first weekend, it's all going to be people that, you know, that know something right. about the book. And I'll give you another example of a very, you know, a close friend of mine he's a space physicist, okay? PhD in space physics, and he studies, like, the time immediately after the Big Bang, okay? And he read Ender's Game. He's going to be a professor at the Air Force Academy. And he said to me, you know, he kind of figured it out. He saw where this was going. He's one of the few people that figured it out before the end of the book. Okay? But couldn't wait to get there because he wasn't sure.
Right.
You know, and he still talks about it and recommends it now to his own mentorees. And so the book is timeless. The book has lessons, and I've told people repeatedly, it's not a book of science fiction. It's a book about morality and sociology. It asks you to ask yourself, what are the moral and sociological limits to what we can do when our society is threatened with extinction?
But see, I think that's true of almost every good science fiction book, is that it's not just a science fiction book, that there's something else, like, behind.
Got the people factor.
Yeah. I mean,
and Ender's Game must be, I would think that Ender's Game would be an attractive fiction book for people in your field. I'm talking about the political science field, because of the Locke and Demosthenes story. You know, I mean, that part, I didn't really appreciate when I was younger, when I first read the book, but I did appreciate it a lot more when I read it in college. I felt that their storyline was actually really interesting when I could understand it. You know, when I read it when I was 12 or whatever, it was just a chapter, part of the chapters that I had to get through, you know. But Peter and Valentine, they're a very interesting dynamic, you know, the way that they go on with life on Earth, and I don't know.
They're very real too.
Yeah,
they're very real, and people inherently know this. There isn't a family, you know. When I was young, I used to think, boy, my family is so unique in any way, good or really bad. Okay, and as I got older, I realized, oh no, I am so right on the average. And the average is so, you know, fat, you know, it's not a spike. Every family has, you know, to some degree, those kinds of dynamics. Now, not every family has a murderous sociopath and someone that's really, really working hard to prevent that, you know, to channel it. But every family has those issues on some point on the continuum. You know, nobody is a sociopath on or off, yes or no, one or zero. On some, you know, it's from uncountable to infinite, right? And you're somewhere along that continuum, right? And all families have to deal with these interactions. So I think that's one thing that makes, you know, Valentine and Peter and Ender very accessible to families. Mm-hmm. There are a lot of older sisters that protect their younger brothers from another older brother.
Okay, so we're going to ask our last question, and that is, I'm going to read another line or another quote from your essay. It's, Ender consistently seeks out and finds whatever each other kid is able to contribute and makes use of that contribution towards achieving his army's goals. So my question is this the key to Ender's leadership success? And can they accurately show this in the movie just by showing him, you know, saying like a couple of compliments to a couple of people, and do you think that would just be the key to like having audiences like him or understanding why people follow him?
That's an interesting question. If I was the director, it's easy to say that because I never will be. but the way to do that is to show, just like in the book, the other army commanders lording it over their you know, their toon mates, and essentially berating them and smacking them down. Whereas Ender doesn't get into any of the feel good, you know, I'm going to compliment you so that you feel good about yourself. He doesn't do that, you know, stuff. Okay. What he does is he just gives people jobs and expects them to do it. And that's what I think they could show. But if it was me, I would contrast one toon leader berating his folks and making it about him being in charge, and about Ender making it clear that everybody has a role to play, because that's exactly what he did. Everybody had a different role. Petra had a different role than Beam, you know, than Alai.
I think one of my favorite parts of Ender's shadow, and I wish I had the book right in front of me, but Bean goes to one of the other kids and asks, I think it's Shen that he talks to about Ender, and Shen explains exactly what it is about Ender that makes people want to follow him. Like, he says that if you spend enough time with Ender, it makes you want him to be proud of you. And,
right.
And Bean is, he doesn't understand that. He doesn't know anything about love, and Bean doesn't understand that these kids follow him, not necessarily because of anything, but that they want to follow him, that they'd die for him, that they'd kill for him, they'd fight for him, and that's what made him, like, a good commander. And I, too, wonder, like, how the movie can show that, you know, very quickly on, that there's, like, a devotion there.
And that is the key. I mean, that is such a key to really good leaders. There are leaders that I've had that I would cross a freeway. I mean, I have this, one of my closest friend in the Air Force, we would talk about people that we would run across a highway on glass, barefoot, naked, to give blood to, if he was, you know. Yet in Ender's Game, it's very clear that there's people that if they were bleeding right in front of you, that most people would walk right past them.
Step over you, yeah. Well, we'll see in November how that goes in the film, right?
Yeah, I'm excited. But even until then, long after then, let's keep telling people about the book and why it's important to read it.
We need to come up with some kind of, like, program where you can, like, keep score of how many people you get to read the book.
I actually read a really cute article this morning. I didn't post about it because I couldn't really find, like, enough information. But there's a town in California, and I guess what they do is, like, the community leaders, like, the board gets together every year, and they make a list of book recommendations for not just, like, the high schools, but for the community. They make these books available to people there. And Ender's Game was actually on the list this year. And you know, they try to go with things that are, you know, they have a theme every year, like things that are a little, that speak about morality, or, you know, give people, like, good, not feel good books, but try to, like, pump people up. And Ender's Game was on the list. I thought that was really cool. And I don't think that's because of the movie coming out. I think I'm consistently seeing, like, did you see that it was, like, on the top? It was number one on the New York Times bestsellers list for paperbacks.
Yeah, yeah.
Crazy.
Yeah. It's back up there. And yeah.
That's wonderful. I mean, there are places around the country where this happens. I'm going to be giving probably next month, or either in July or early August, a seminar in Lexington and Louisville called Ender on Tap: The Sociology of Ender's Game, where we're going to meet in a tavern somewhere and talk about the sociology of Ender's Game. And I'm doing that for Ideas Festival University, which is run by the Kentucky Science and Technology Corporation. There are seminars for people that want to take a seminar or a class in something that they don't want to apply to go to college for. Does that make sense? And to get them to think about things that they didn't think about before, learn something that they didn't know about before, you know, beekeeping for non-beekeepers, that kind of thing. And I'm excited to talk about that. And that was, you know, I had some other suggestions that I gave to them, but what they really wanted was that sociology of Ender's Game. That's one that people would really like to go listen to. And I think it has to do with the timeless. There are timeless truths and timeless conundrums that Scott Card put in that book.
Okay, well, we want to thank Colonel Tom Ruby for joining us today. We hope you had a fun time talking with us about Ender's Game. We really enjoyed our conversation with you.
Yeah.
I appreciate it, ladies. I'm very happy to talk to you both, Crystal and Kelly. I love this topic. I wish everybody would have the opportunity at some point to to drive, you know, even within a few hours to go see Orson Scott Card at a book signing at some point, read his books and read his other books, because they all pose very, very interesting questions. And read a lot, okay? Read a lot of different kinds of books. And then you'll get to do something that Orson Scott Card talked about in a presentation once, when he said, it's better to think ahead of time what to do in a situation before you see it, rather than to be surprised and to have to react when you're in it. And I would just keep recommending to people to read the book.
We will definitely do that.
It's
not hard to do.
It's a personal goal of mine to read at least 50 books this year. I'm at about 22, so.
Oh, yeah, on your blog, yeah, I've seen your list.
I'm on schedule, so hopefully I'll make it at the end of the year.
That's great. Let me know if you need help. I'll give you my reading list, and you can work your way down that, too.
I think I will take you up on that. I'm going to have to add Starship Troopers to the list for sure now, because since you brought it back into my head. Anyway, so you guys can check out Tom's website. It's bgcts.com, and that stands for Bluegrass Critical Thinking Solutions. And you guys can check out some of his papers and things like that. Thank you for coming on and talking to us, Tom.
Yes, thank you so much. We had a good time.
Thank you, ladies.
You'll have to come back on in November. Come back on in November after you've seen the film. We'll talk about it, okay?
Yeah.
I really look forward to it. I appreciate that. Thank you very much, and have a good week.
Thank you. You too.
And we just want to say thank you to all of our listeners. You can catch all of our past episodes at our website, www.endercast.com. We are also on iTunes. You can follow us on Facebook at EG Endercast, and that is our Facebook address as well. Thank you for listening. Bye, guys.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.